Our speaker today, Captain Jeff Klein, is a senior lecturer in the Naval Postgraduate School's Operations Research Department at Monterey, and he serves as the National Security Institute's Program Director for Maritime Defense and Security Research Programs. He oversees over 30 research programs associated with maritime defense, as well as global security studies related to piracy. He has also over 26 years of naval operational experience, including command of two U.S. Navy ships, and serving as operations deputy for Commander 6th Fleet. In addition to his sea service, he spent 3 years as a naval analyst in the office of the Secretary of Defense. Let's welcome Captain Jeff Klein.
Richard, thank you very much, and thank you for the opportunity to the Commonwealth Club to discuss issues related to our maritime global domain and maritime security. Of course, what people always like to talk about is really piracy. And so what I'd like to do this evening is start off with that, discuss some of the things that are history, a little bit of history of the piracy, what's occurring around the world today, what we can learn from that about the challenges associated with our maritime common, and how we can potentially help secure that common for the good of the world. And then, like most talks like this, the real interesting stuff comes out of the question and answer period, so I'll leave some time for that. Well, before the headlines that the Somali pirates caused us, most Americans related to piracy based on the Caribbean and our early colonial history. Names like Blackbeard, Edward Teach, Anne Bonny, Mary Read, Gentleman Calico Jack, and, of course, Henry Morgan shaped an entire imagination of generation of Americans and frequently ended up in our movies as well. But, of course, piracy has existed since man first went to the sea and started sea trade itself. Bands of Chinese pirates preyed on Asian trade years ago. And what's not well known is many people pirate Western countries practiced piracy, from Romans, the Knights Templar, the Knights of St. John. In fact, of course, the Barbary pirates that had such a large impact on our early Navy. Thomas Jefferson sent a fledgling Navy in order on his first major deployment to combat the Barbary pirates in the early 1800s, and from that experience shaped our Navy leadership, which had such a large impact later in the War of 1812. So our country is not without its history and without its experience in this international criminal activity. But modern piracy is not so romantic. Indonesian pirates practiced sea robbery in the local areas of the South China Sea, stealing entire ships. Nigerian pirates, combined with insurgents, attack oil platforms, hold people for ransom. And, of course, we're most familiar recently with the Somali pirates, which focus on taking large cargo ships and their crew for hostage, and sometimes rich yachts that go through the area as well. Most famous of that and recent that captured the America's attention was, of course, the Maersk Alabama incident, when the bravery of that captain more than a year ago, offering himself as a hostage in order to trade both the safety of his crew and his ship when the pirates were threatened and they took to this small boat. And then he himself was later rescued by a maritime force and maritime special operators. What's not well known is the second attack that occurred on Maersk Alabama not more than 4 to 5 months later. That attack was not well publicized because it was not successful. And the reason why, I believe, is because the Maersk Alabama at that time had an armed team on board, and the pirates were deterred by live gunfire. There's been 4,000 attacks in the last 10 years, or reported attacks in the last 10 years, around the world and around our trading areas. Frequently, those pirates and the frequency of those attacks have gone down except for two major areas, the Gulf of Guinea outside Nigeria and of course the Gulf of Aden and the Indian Ocean off the coast of Somalia. But those are reported attacks. We don't actually know where and what the real level of attacks are worldwide because these attacks are voluntary. They come through the International Maritime Bureau. The International Maritime Bureau is a subset of the International Chamber of Commerce. You can visit their website, and they have the latest pirate reports that occur on a daily basis. In fact, last night I checked that website, and the last one, a reported attack, was last night at 2000 local. A skiff of five Somalia men attacked a container ship and was successfully driven off, both by the defense measures that the captain did by increasing speed, making radical course change, and finally, again, by live gunfire from the security team on board. Focusing just on Somalia, those statistics from the International Maritime Bureau, we have actually a doubling of pirate attacks between 2008 and 2009. There were 111 reported attacks in the year 2008. In 2009, there were 209 attacks. Now, this is significant because the naval forces that were established off the coast of Somalia were established in December of 2008. So the number of reported attacks actually doubled after we started putting naval forces in the region. Also interesting, about 42 to 43 attacks for both years were successful. So the number of reported attacks have doubled, but the number of successful attacks have stayed about the same. In the first half of this year, there's been over 100 reported attacks, and 27 of those have been successful. Well, what do we know about these? We know that the pirate attacks off the coast of Somalia are going further out in the Indian Ocean. We believe that's occurring because of the naval forces that are established around Somalia, and I'll have more on those comments later. But we also have recognized throughout history, whether we're talking about modern-day pirates or those pirates from the Caribbean, the pirates actually require four things. And if you remove those four things, then in a way you can help understand how to combat piracy. The first is ungoverned land space. They need a place to operate from or a land base to operate from. The second is men, material, and boats, and fuel in order to operate in the seas. The third is ungoverned territorial waters. That is, they have to be able to go from their land across territorial waters to the shipping lanes, which is the fourth requirement, normally in the proximity of shipping lanes. Anytime you interrupt any four of those elements, you make it a life a challenge for the piracy. Well, let's take a look at the other side. There are some say that piracy is no big deal, particularly not to the commercial world. And we have to pay attention to those arguments because here's what they are. There were 23,000 trips annually through the Gulf of Aden. 23,000. There were only 42 successful pirate attacks. If you're an insurance person, you'll insure that. That's not very challenging at all. In fact, you might say it's more dangerous to walk across the street in San Francisco. The amount of ransom that was paid out last year in 2009, of course, we don't know exactly what that number is, but the maximum estimate is $200 million. You have to compare $200 million paid out in ransom to the approximately $7 to $9 trillion worth of trade that occurs on the oceans of the seas. Well, seeing from that, it's not a bad bet in order to insure against piracy as well. So it could be seen as just an insurance hiccup. In fact, for a long time, international commerce saw it just as the cost of doing business. But as larger and global thinkers against the global domain, we have to be concerned about other issues related to piracy as well. Yes, the cost of piracy is low, and yes, there are very low odds of being attacked. But there's issues with the fact that piracy interrupts the concept of the freedom of the seas. And there's no navy in existence that can not take on that challenge, because that's why navies exist, is to ensure that that doctrine, which is established, in fact, by the Asians and Romans years ago, continue to maintain. It can also be seen as a threat to the world energy source, as an example, the Sirius Star, or as a threat to worldwide commerce, as I mentioned before, the Maersk Alabama. Then again, there's also the growing issue of dirty money. Once you start collecting that much money, you start becoming a target for international crime. You run the risk, in fact, we've seen this, of corrupt governments. And now we have, for a fact, know that piracy in Somalia is starting to support the insurgents and terrorists there because al-Shabaab has claimed, that's a direct tie to al-Qaeda, that they are starting to receiving funds and considering running piracy operations themselves to start to fund their arms and their personnel. So what are we doing off Somalia? What is the United States and the international community? Well, in any one day, we have anywhere from 30 to 40 ships patrolling the Gulf of Aden in various patrols. They're formed by several task groups, the Coalition Task Force 151, currently commanded by a Turkish admiral, has several ships in it, including U.S. ships. That's where we put our ships. We make constant patrols off the Gulf of Aden and outside of Somalia. There's also Russian ships, Chinese ships, the EU naval forces there working in conjunction, and we're starting to talk to each other and starting to do coordinated patrols in the area. We've also established regional agreements. The Dubai Accord, through various countries, agrees to share information and, in fact, to not only show where the pirates are coming from but where they're potentially attacking. And finally, we're engaging foreign countries in order to take legal action, such as Kenya, whose courts, by the way, are filled now, and supporting those countries that take on pirates in the region through money and of course, support for their judicial system. It's expensive to try pirates, and it's expensive to keep them in jails after you have actually found them guilty. Well, what can we learn from piracy that has a broader message toward maritime security in itself? Well, there are several threats to maritime security in the maritime domain, and this is probably the biggest one. It's weather. And you say, well, we can't do anything against weather. We can fight piracy. But that's not true. There's some real insights as far as weather. We've established a global sensor system in order to understand when major storms like this will interrupt shipping. We've established both sensors, command and control, and warning networks to ensure that mariners avoid such catastrophic events. Likewise, we could set up a similar program to fight the threats to the maritime domain. And what are those threats? Well, there are come in two broad categories in non-state actors. The first is those that use the commons, the maritime commons, for nefarious reasons. They may be smugglers of drugs or of humans. They're also polluters. The entire Pacific Gyra, which is full of plastic, is a testament to that. There is illegal, unregulated, and underreported fishing that occurs in the maritime domain, which is of great concern to our African allies. And, of course, there's mass migration, which is a concern to our European allies. I've mentioned the other set of non-state actors, which is those that try to interfere with shipping. Pirates, of course, is an example by the Maersk Alabama, which is the way I started this discussion, but also terrorists. This is a 2009 event that was the attack on the port of Assad in Israel, where suicide bombers actually approached and were supplied by the sea in order to attack the support itself. Of course, terrorists can also attack and interfere shipping at sea, which this attack occurred in 2002 from Luxor, and of course, we all know about the coal and are familiar with that attack that occurred in the off of Yemen, or in Yemen. You might also have recently heard about, of course, the Japanese ship, the M-Star, that was attacked just recently by Iranian terrorists, we believe, in the Gulf of Hormuz. So how do we establish the maritime common, and what are the elements that we do to establish security? Well, there's actually three major elements, whether you're talking about piracy, pollution, IUU fishing, or whether you're talking about even weather in that case, with the exception of the law, of course. One is you have to have knowledge. You have to know about the domain. You have to have a way in which to collect information, fuse that information, and get it out to people who need to know about it. You need platforms for sensors in order to sense the environment, to understand the threat, to actually maybe deter, and then potentially respond to those things that you learn. And finally, you need to have some sort of legal jurisdiction in which to act, either against non-staked actors for those using for nefarious means, such as smugglers, or for the pirates and the terrorists that we just discussed. Well, let's take a little closer look at each one of these. The first, of course, is the knowledge component. We have to understand what we commonly call the maritime domain awareness. In order to gain maritime domain awareness, we need both intelligence and sensors and data to come into a central place or central areas, whether that's regional or whether that's global, understand that information, and then send it out to either other fusion centers, state leaderships, platforms at sea, law enforcement, and interdiction platforms in order to take action on those. This, of course, is just not global. It can also be regional. We need those platforms, whether they're surface platforms or air platforms, both to act as a deterrent, to collect that information, and to respond over the seas in some way to establish that legal regime over the territorial seas. Then finally, we need a legal regime to operate. Within 12 miles outside the land, most countries are in charge or responsible for their own territorial seas. Outside of that is international waters, and because of that, we need things like the UN Resolution for Law of the Sea, or the SOLAS, which is Safety of Lives at Sea. We also need the UN resolutions that we've recently passed for Somalia, 1816, UN Resolution 1816, which allowed us to take action in Somalia territorial waters. 1851 and 1896, those resolutions allowed us to do counter-piracy operations ashore if we wish. We also need to establish regional agreements and trust on sharing of information. So we've done that in many cases by holding symposiums around the world to understand different people's perspectives. For example, if you talk to the west coast of Africa, yes, they recognize that piracy is a problem, but they recognize that IUU fishing is a national problem, and we need to be aware and sensitive to those issues. And so we inspire those regional agreements and cooperations, help us establish maritime regional security in the region itself. RECAP is the regional agreement for protection or combating armed robbery at sea and against piracy. That's between Malaysia, Indonesia, and Singapore, and provide a model for those regional-type agreements that I was discussing. What can the U.S. do? Well, the U.S. is in fact, involved in several different aspects to inspire all three elements. In many cases, for those countries that aren't able to establish jurisdiction over their own territorial seas, we provide them small boats, we provide them radios, and we provide them small command centers to actually start meeting the three requirements that you need to establish maritime security over waters. We also are involved in regional agreements, help inspiring them, and we focus on the larger issue of global maritime issues, both with partner sharing and for intelligence and for platforms and response. Well, that's really sums up my formal comments, and I wanted to keep it down to about 20 minutes because I know you have a lot of questions or at least might be interested in what we're currently doing in both the United States level or regional level with piracy. And so I'll just open it up for questions now and see where the conversation takes us.
Yes, I'd like a little more information on IU fishing. First, what the phrase IU stands for and what our government is able to do about illegal fishing throughout the world.
That's a great question. It's actually IUU fishing, and I always have to remember this as well. It is illegal, unregulated, and unreported fishing. And, of course, that is a particular concern to all countries with fisheries in their economic zone or 200 nautical miles off their shores. It concerns them for several reasons. First is if the fishes are taken without proper taxing or they lose revenue. They may lose the fish themselves. That's a concern. IUU fishing comes from all over the place. In fact, some of our own fishers in the United States are guilty of it. They go to different regions of the world and collect fish in the EEZ or economic zones of various countries without permission and without actually paying that area. Excuse me, the country's tax or licensing fees in order to take fishes from that area. So one is a loss of revenue. The other is, of course, the loss of fish. Fish is the number one protein and consumer of the world outside the United States. So Chinese fleets, Japanese fleets, and Norwegian fleets go around the world to collect these fishes themselves. What can the United States do? The United States can actually help the countries the same way establish territorial sovereignty over those waters the same way we would be if we were concerned about piracy or concerned about terrorism. We need to help them establish both the platforms and sensors and fusion centers for them to respond and essentially be able to exercise their international sovereignty in the waters in which they actually employ. Now, we are concerned with IUU fishing in the United States as well. And in fact, the United States Navy is now helping the Coast Guard in that effort, particularly in the Pacific. We don't actually go aboard, the Navy doesn't go aboard and arrest anyone, but we do provide both the platforms for the sensors, collecting the intelligence, and then report that to the Coast Guard and allow the, and in some cases, be the platform that carry the law enforcement officers in order to enforce our national rights on their fishing grounds as well.
It was my understanding from, I'm not quite sure if I read this or I heard it on a radio program, that most of the people who are captured, who are the pirates, are actually some poor guys who don't have any money or they're paid a little bit of money to do this. How well is the effort going to get the money people behind it, and are any of them actually being prosecuted, and do the people who actually did the piracy, these guys who were being paid to do it, how are they prosecuted as opposed to the folks who are actually running the operation?
Yeah, that's a very insightful question. There's arguments that have been made, and in some way justified, that the Somalia piracy didn't really occur until the fishers of Somalia, having no Coast Guard because they lost the government, started to try to enforce their own fishing grounds against interlopers in the Somalia fishers area. They quickly found that to be very lucrative, particularly for young men with no jobs, no income, no government, etc. And so they started piracy on the small scale. That could be true, and there might be some justifiable arguments behind that, because you could say that poverty breeds crime. I'm not sure that I could actually argue against that point. However, your question is insightful because what you're saying is exactly what we're starting to look at now. This is now becoming a big international business, both from the terrorist side and from the international criminal side. When you start paying that much in millions of dollars in ransom, you start collecting the attention of more than just local warlords. So the money side is starting to be looked at now, but only recently, within the last year. For example, property prices and houses in northern Kenya have risen dramatically. And the reason they have is because Somalis with money have been going across the border and starting to buy real estate. So we as in the collective global we and international law enforcement, are starting to consider using the same techniques that we try to combat drugs for piracy as well. The answer to your question is we haven't started to try the kingpins yet. The reason why is Somalia represents that ungoverned land space that pirates can flourish in. And we don't really have, we're trying to establish, we again, the international community, in fact, the Irish troops are on the ground now trying to establish some sort of help Somali transitional government, establish that government in the regions that they're worried about. But they haven't yet. Because of that, we haven't grabbed anybody or prosecuted anyone at all in the court system for the kingpins or the warlords or the people who are providing the money, because we haven't identified them nor have we arrested them. The actual pirates, the young men who are acting as the pirates, those that we have actually taken to court, that's one of the interesting challenges that we have with international piracy. You may have followed in the news that the United States defense defense attorneys for the pirates in Virginia particularly had the charge of piracy actually thrown out. The reason why is the definition of piracy. Since the United States has not ratified the UN Law of the Sea, or UNCLOS yet, which has a clear definition of piracy, we had to accept our original definition from the 1800s, what piracy is. And when that law was written, everybody knew what piracy was, but not by today's legal standards. Piracy in that time, you actually had to be on board the ship and taken the ship. The ones that we have caught were either caught because they fired on Navy ships or because we took them in the process of acting as piracy. Because of that, we've had to charge them under different rules of law within the United States. That's not true for Kenya, which is trying it under different laws, and it's not true for Sweden. So bottom line is we have no world court to try piracy. It has to be tried by nations of the world, and each of those nations have a different jurisprudence that actually approaches to that. Long answer, I know, but I hope I covered all your questions on that.
Thank you for your presentation, by the way. Question actually about domestic security, not so much piracy. I always read conflicting accounts about how safe our ports are in the United States, and what are we as a country doing in terms of homeland security efforts, port authority efforts, and or Coast Guard efforts to make our global trade safer for the U.S., because we are obviously a net importer versus a net exporter, and whether it's inexpensive goods from Asia or oil from the Middle East, just curious how that's impacting our security efforts in the ports.
That is a good question. In fact, this morning I just flew in from Key West, and I was addressing that with our Joint Interagency Task Force South, which is in charge as a national task force in order to combat counter drugs coming in from Latin America and all illicit trade. When they take a look at all illicit trade outside of just counter drugs, that also means potential threats of other nature, particularly from potential terrorist organizations. Every port, every major port in the United States has a Coast Guard captain called the port captain that's in charge of that port. He runs something called the Maritime Security Committee. That Maritime Security Committee, he hopes, is composed of voluntarily of the federal and local agencies that are associated with security of that port. But security of the port's not unlike establishing jurisdiction over water. He has to have sensors and information. He has to have that from cross interagencies. He has to have that from commercial shippers, which sometimes, rightfully so, is wary about sharing information with the government, particularly when it's business-sensitive information, because they, of course, don't want their competitors to know it. So it's a complex issue within the ports themselves, but they have stood up the maritime security committees to both share information. Some of our ports actually have joint operation centers that have the FBI, the Navy, the Coast Guard, the local police, the firefighters all in one area. Notably of those are Charleston, that's called Seahawk, and San Diego, which is called a Jayhawk, Joint Harbor Operations Center. And they have formalized those centers in order to share information for that very reason. The Port of San Francisco and the Port of Oakland both have port captains and their maritime security issues as well. That's to share with both local threats and international threats. Of course, Customs and Border Protection, our CBT people, of course, are faced with a very complex issue with the number of containers that come in. They have to rely very heavily on that information and intelligence in order to do smart and intelligent targeting of those containers, because they simply don't have the assets in order to inspect them all, although Congress has required it now for the last 2 years. So they are part of that security organization within ports as well, and a necessary first line of defense for cargoes and equipment actually coming into the port. Is it a complex problem? Yes. Do we have a long way to go? Yes. But I will tell you that I firmly believe that the solutions are local, not national. And what I mean by that, there's an old saying that says, once you visited one port, you visited one port. And the reason why is because ports are all operated differently under different jurisdictions, different states, different counties, under different port authorities and different port captains. And so the regional solution is cooperation, and we started to see a lot of that around the country.
How often are boats financed, chartered, flagged, and crewed by different countries in order to obscure liability and responsibility, and is that a problem?
Wow. You're talking about commercial ships?
Yeah.
Oh. It's not uncommon for a commercial ship to be owned by one country, flagged by another country, captained by a third country, crewed by a fourth country, insured by a fifth country, and cargo belongs to six or seven different countries. The jurisdiction that's associated with ships, of course, belong to the flag vessel. But your question is insightful because when a pirate act occurs, you're affecting many more countries and international community than just the ship that's flagged. For example, most ships fly under flags of convenience. Those flags of convenience, like Panama, Liberia, are countries that have small licensing fees in order to operate and have not as strict as inspections as a U.S. flag vessel or requirements for the vessel itself. So that's inspired by it. Liabilities then follow that as well. I mean, who is liable for the ship at certain times? Well, you would like to say legally it's always the captain or the flag country, but since those sometimes are different nationalities, there's issues that are related to that. How often commercial shippers do this specifically to hide liability is an insightful question again, and I'm not really qualified to answer that because you're saying or the question is how many unscrupulous shippers do we have? I doubt our U.S. owners or European owners or most responsible Asian owners or Saudi owners do that, and the reason why is because they're dealing with expensive just-in-time delivery, spot market of oil, commodities. They don't want to lose those cargoes, whoever they're moving their cargoes, so they're going to ship with reputable shippers. It's the tramp steamers, the slow movers, and that sort of thing that we have to watch out for, not just for piracy per se, but also for pollution, for collision, and safety of navigation. But going back to your real point is a ship, most cargo ships, most commercial ships out there today are actually a microcosm of international communities.
You made those comments about establishing your hegemony in a fishing area. That's all confined to the idea, to the limit of the 200-mile limit or not?
Yes. Essentially, there's, according to UN law of the sea, that although our Senate is not ratified yet by presidential, actually it's by the common leadership of both our Navy, our Coast Guard, and Marine Corps, we recognize it. From our baseline coast to 12 nautical miles is territorial seas. Everything that occurs in there is sovereign territory. So piracy can't occur within that region. That's called sea robbery, and every country is responsible for enforcing sea robbery from that first 12 nautical miles. This is critical when you talk about Indonesia. Indonesia was very sensitive for many years about focusing on safety of navigation in the Straits of Malacca. They just didn't have the resources to establish that sensors, those awareness and platforms through the Straits of Malacca, but they did not want foreign countries to come in to do that because that was part of their territorial seas. From 12 miles out to 24 nautical miles out is another region, a zone of interest that we share, or the UN law of the sea allows somewhat more jurisdiction by a territorial country. And then from 24 out to 200 is the economic zone, which means that the country has mineral rights and fishing rights and that sort of thing in that region.
So this dilemma that's going on in the South China Sea now with China trying to muscle their way, muscle all the other nations out aside. How is that working out? Is it totally outside the law? Or
no, what? No. It's what happens is, I've given you those limits. If all countries, bordering maritime countries, were greater than 200 nautical miles apart from each other, then there would be no problem. Unfortunately, there's not. So there's overlapping jurisdictions. What you're reading, though, in the press today between China and Japan isn't really a overlapping maritime claim. It goes back to actually the 1890s when in one of the wars between China and Japan, Japan actually took over the islands and retained them through World War II and even passed – oh, actually, retained them through World War II. After that, the United States took over the jurisdiction of those because those islands, the Daiku Islands, are actually south of Okinawa. We took over jurisdiction of them, but then when we transitioned Okinawa back to Japan, we transitioned those islands as well. But all the competing claims for Vietnam, the Philippines, China, all fall into the region of that economic zone issue. And, of course, the real issue is underlying energy sources, on undersea bed sources. It's something very close that we're watching, of course, very close, because the strength of the Chinese Navy is increasing, its reach is increasing, and so it's something that I think the American people do need to watch, which is a whole separate talk. I'll be happy to talk another half hour on that as well. But
so the Spratly Islands are within this overlapping of 200-mile zones?
Oh, very definitely, yes. Between the Spratly Islands have several claims. Now, the Spratlys are different from the Daco Islands between Japan and China. That's in the East China Sea. The Spratlys are in the South China Sea. That is a territorial claim issue between Vietnam, the Philippines, and China.
Can I pick up on what you just said with regard to China? I heard that China has now a new Navy doctrine, I believe they call it far distance defense, and they plan to build aircraft carriers, which they haven't done so far because so far they have focused on their coastal waters and their defense and Taiwan, etc. So could you tell us a few words what you think about the far distance defense of China?
The U.S. Navy is concerned with what we're calling the anti-access denial capabilities throughout the world of different navies and their reach off the coast. China's established several different strategies, maritime strategies. One is called the First Island Chain, the Second Island Chain. Those are to establish their reach, their naval reach out further and further away from their coast. And what you're talking about, far defense, is exactly that. The other is a concept called string of pearls, which also is closely related to far defense. That string of pearls represents local bases in which they operate from Burma, from Pakistan, in order to protect their own sea routes that occur and the energy routes from the Middle East around to China. The other interesting aspect about this is that, of course, the Chinese are operating now and learning a lot of experience about distance operations the same way we did in the early 1800s by combating piracy, because they're maintaining ships in the Gulf of Aden. They are coordinating and holding conferences with other navies in order to cooperate against combating piracy. But what they're learning is distance operations, how to supply, support, warships further and further from their coast. So I would say that I believe we're going to see a continued expansion of the People's Liberation Army Navy, continued technology advancements, and I think that China, this is Jeff Klein's opinion, of course, will start to make bolder and bolder claims as they gain more capability in this area. Essentially, their actions are following their doctrine and their statements.
It's a remedial history question. If the Barbary Coast was in Morocco, if I'm correct in that.
Tunisia and Algiers.
Okay.
Yeah.
How did San Francisco get that title?
I'm sorry?
How did San Francisco become the Barbary Coast? It's often referred
to. Oh, well, you know, I'll defer to the local San Franciscans here, but I would probably say by the same lifestyle and the same pirate-type attitude. Actually, I should say that Key West was a haven for pirates, but a different form of pirate. What they would do is they would put up false navigation aids around certain rocks and keys specifically to run commercial ships ashore, and then they would come out and save the crew. And then they would, of course, take the cargo. So, that's right. It became salvage then, of course. And they became known as the Key West Pirates. Now, I'm not sure we had any equivalent here on the coast, but I would probably say that takes a lot of innovation and ingenuity in order to do that. So maybe that's why we're known for our innovation spirit. I don't know.
Hello. I've got a question, and I'm not understanding why these ships don't arm themselves to the teeth. Is it just simply not economically a good business decision to make? Or it seems like when I see the pictures, they're fairly small crews, they're very small boats that they're on, that I'm not understanding how they're pulling it off.
That's a great question. Well, actually, you made a question and a statement. One is they are minimally manned crewed for financial reasons. If you go to the International Maritime Bureau site, they publish a best practices, or it's called best maritime practices to combat piracy. And they do have great advice there on how to put razor wire around the ship to prevent boarding, how to increase speed, to have maybe citadels where the crews go to. But they specifically advise not to use gunfire against pirates. The argument on the commercial world, and I've engaged with the vice president of Chevron for security on this several times, he and I fall on different sides of the fence on this, is first it's an insurance issue. We talked about the fact that out of 23,000 transits, only 41 were successful pirate attacks. Most maritime insurers will tell you that if you start arming untrained crews, your gun accidents are going to be higher, and therefore they don't want to insure against gun accidents for the crews. They also don't want to get embroiled in a wrongful death claim, so that if a overzealous crew member shoots a Somalia fisherman, as he's a fisherman, realize that all Somalia fishermen are armed. They're out there fishing. So you sometimes, the difference between a Somalia fisherman and a pirate is one of opportunity, or whether the fishing is good or not. So if they're concerned that the insurance rates are concerned for wrongful death, in fact, that question was asked by one ship that had a shot a pirate, but he was also not boarded yet, so the question was whether he was fishing or whether they were just moving toward the fish or toward the ship itself. So one's insurance. The other is legal access to ports. There are many ports around the world that do not allow commercial ships in if they know that they have arms on board. So of those best practices that the IMB puts out, one of them is not to use, first, don't arm your crew. Second, you shouldn't really have security teams on board. But because the conversations I've had both with IMB representatives, IMO representatives, and commercial shippers themselves, the last bullet on that list of things is state troops might be a different issue. And what do I mean by state troops? I mean putting a fire team or half of a squad of Marines on board ships as they transit through the Gulf of Aden. Not all of them. We don't have enough for that. But randomly put them out there. Or French troops or Chinese troops, just to make it increase the level of risk for all pirates who are approaching, whether they're actually going to be met with armed force or not. We do know analytically and historically that the best way to protect a ship is on that ship. So, in fact, I've been arguing for several years now that the number of forces that we have out there, 40 number ships, the millions of dollars it takes to keep a cruiser and destroyer on station, that is not as effective as actually putting small teams, fire teams on board ships randomly, because that's the best way to protect the ships themselves. So there's two sides to that argument. Now, U.S. law requires, now Congress has passed a law that any U.S. flag vessel that goes into Somalia has got to have a security team on board, which is why all the Maersk lines that have been providing the humanitarian aid into Mogadishu has been going on with security teams now.
How about the attacks on the oil rigs? I didn't know much about that. How many are successful, and how would you define a successful attack? What happens?
Now, by oil rigs, you're talking about the Nigerian. Yeah, the Nigerian. Most of the attacks on oil rigs and oil terminals are occurring by the Nigerian pirates or insurgents or terrorists or men or freedom fighters, depending on which side of the argument you actually fall on. The men for years have made the argument that Nigerian oil profits have not been getting down to the people and causing mass pollution within the Niger River and the Niger River Delta. I have some sympathy with that because I've seen actual evidence of that. So their attacks are, one, political, but they also are now moving toward ransom. Within the last month, they have captured crews in order to hold for ransom to collect money as well. They have not stopped the flow of oil out of Nigeria, but it is a U.S. concern because 10% of our oil comes from Nigeria. So Nigeria is a major, it's the largest and multi-racial and multi-religious country in Africa, as well as a major oil producer for the United States. So we are focused on the Gulf of Guinea. The attacks have occurred both against ships and oil platforms. They have been successful in stealing oil and stealing some of the bunkered oil, and again, in order to sell it, and recently for ransoming. But it's affected about 10% of the flow. Is that the cost of doing business for oil companies? It still is. They want us to go in, as in the United States, and we have. AFRICOM and NAVIR has gone in to set up radio stations along the coast, AIS and radar receivers. We've given them platforms to help patrol their areas, and we've worked with the Nigerian forces. But we have bought out, not we, the United States, but the Nigerian government has bought out many different organizations in order to try to buy down some of that threat. But it's still an issue, and still an issue in the population.
Oh, do they ever try to explode the oil rigs?
Oh, sure. No, they attack with RPGs and AK-47s. Absolutely.
Have they been successful in doing that very often?
No, not like the like what we saw, of course, in the Gulf of Mexico. Nothing to that level. Most of the time what happens is they do damage to piping or pumping, which is quickly secured because oil is money. So they do damage to infrastructure, but nothing like the dramatic events that we saw, the accident that occurred in the Gulf.
In your opening remarks, you mentioned oceanic pollution in passing, and I wonder if you could briefly comment on our government's role in that, and particularly this plastic cesspool in the North Pacific.
Wow, you're asking the wrong spouse on this one. My wife, the marine scientist who's behind you, would probably be able to answer those issues better than I. I think that our country actually is doing a good job leading the way to try to combat the trash that's going into the ocean. What we're doing to actually clean that up is a whole different issue. It's a large problem. It's a large problem for the ecology and the biosystems in the Pacific. So we should be concerned about it, stopping it, essentially. I hope that there's some process for breaking down. I'm not a chemist, and I hope that the Earth would somehow be able to absorb it, but we don't think so. Instead, it just gets smaller and smaller pieces and larger pieces. That's a way of saying that we're concerned about it. Sometimes we track it. We're certainly concerned about ships are concerned about ingesting it. But I think the best thing that we can do as a country is just be very careful about our use of plastics and how we throw them out. That's as far as I can go on that one. That is really, I think, a issue not so much of willful polluters as it is inconsiderate polluters. Does that make sense? We have willful polluters around the world who make dumpings. Those we can do something about. That's illegal both in international and national law. We can take direct action on that. What we really need to do is discipline ourselves for the larger problem.
The Commonwealth Club organizes many cruises. How frequent are attacks on cruise ships?
Well, they're not unknown. We know the Achille Laurel, of course. That was an attack on a cruise ship, a terrorist attack in the Mediterranean. There has been sea robbery incidences in the South China Seas. Those sea robbery incidences are normally when the ship is at port. People board, come on, and they're just after your watch, your money, anything they can steal quickly. Cruise ships are a major concern for terrorist targets within the United States. Security is, for example, cruise ships, and every time they go into the Key West area, because the channel is so narrow, they go in with an armed escort. The Coast Guard provides armed escorts for cruise ships anywhere that we believe that they would not be able to turn and run quickly. So it is an issue, it is a concern, but most of the incidents we've seen, besides the most dramatic events, have been basic robbery of people on board, and most of the time that occurs at anchor, to be honest, the robbers, the sea robbers. And notice I use that term quite, they're pirates in the sense that they're doing piratical type action, but because they're normally in territorial waters, they become sea robbers, and they actually go aboard specifically for cash, money, or your jewelry.
What is the most creative method of attack you've heard of? And maybe you could tell for those of us not real up on this, just what they typically do. How do they scale up these huge ships and so forth?
Yeah, well, let me answer that question because I have to answer it in two regions. The least imaginative is the Nicaraguan pirates because, I'm sorry, the Nigerian pirates. The Nigerian pirates, because they have very standard small boat tactics that that most navies use all over the world. The Somali pirates have actually gone to a dual system now, where they have two boats attack simultaneously. Normally sneak up behind the commercial vessel, usually on the port side, and they have scaling ladders that they throw on top the stern itself in order to quickly crawl up. They send one or two people to take command of the bridge to slow the ship down so that the rest of the pirates can come on board. The two boat operation is one boat captures the attention of the captain of the vessel, of the commercial ship, while the other one offers the one that comes on and sneaks aboard. The most unique ones are the Indonesian pirates, as far as I'm concerned, because they have made an art of this for many years through the Straits of Malacca. They don't use scaling ladders as much as poles. They have huge poles that look like large candy canes, and very young men climb up these things rapidly toward the stern of the ship. The modus operandi is the same. But the daring and the physical feat that's required to do that is simply amazing. There was a television special several years ago where the reporter actually went to the out areas of the Indonesian islands to interview the pirates that occurred from there. And his theme of his show was that the pirates were opportunists. They were actually business people. When the economy was slow or tourism was slow, they would turn around and come out and actually take sea robbery actions through the Straits of Malacca. And they actually demonstrated the technique of having to have this huge cane pole that they would hook on the stern of the ship and quickly crawl up it. And that would send two or three people overboard that way. Which now you can see why the defensive measures, Constantine wire, razor wire, a sharp lookout astern, increasing speed, radical maneuvers, make that boarding process difficult, which is what the International Maritime Bureau recommends commercial ships do in order to prevent that boarding.
If I remember correctly, in Nigeria, was it not where Ken Sarawiwa was killed? He was officially done in by the government because of political issues that you talked about, having to do with the fact that there is no trickle-down effect and that the local tribe people get zero out of all this oil money. Is it politically getting any better? Because he died many years ago. And had a government trial and the whole thing, or is it about the same so that everything is basically just going to stay the same for all the people in that area who not only are extremely poor, but like you say, that whole area is totally polluted because of the oil?
I don't think it's totally polluted yet. Every 5 to 7 years, there's a huge program that the government negotiates with the insurgent groups, large arms turn in, large boats turn in, that sort of thing. And normally that's a coming together again of the very tribal units. And then something sparks some breakup from that. And usually what happens because of the turn-in is they buy arms. There's a money flow that occurs from the central government down to the insurgent groups. Those insurgent groups then recognize that. They turn their arms in. And then something happens, it breaks up again, and we ramp up that 7 to 10 year cycle again. I'm not sure about your first question because I'm not familiar with that particular trial, but I am familiar with what's currently happening, and we just went through one of those cycles where there was a large arm turn in about 2 years ago, and now the attacks are starting to pick up again. So I think if you ask the insurgents in the Niger Delta, they would say, that no, things aren't getting better and haven't been getting better and won't get better until there's a change of government. Now, that is not the only problem the Nigerian government has. There's, in the northern part of the country, there's huge religious and ethnic problems that occur there between Muslims, the local religion, and Christians. And that battle's been going on separately from the issues related to the Niger Delta. So it is an important country for us for energy source. But I believe it's also probably an important country for us because they receive our funds that we hope to see them mature beyond many of the challenges that they're having.
We have time for one more question. Well, I'll ask one. Are there any women among the pirates?
Well, I will tell you, not recently, but the most famous pirates in histories have been women. The most powerful pirate in history is a woman by the name of Madame Cheng, and she ran the largest pirate organization in China. She inherited a smaller organization when her husband died, and she grew that to one of the most powerful pirate countries, I can say, that threatened the South China Sea and all its trade. She became a political entity in herself. I showed you Anne Bonny and Mary Read. Interestingly enough, both of those young women came over from England and were enticed by Gentleman Calico Jack in order to join him on his ship, and they became pirates in their own rights as well. So I think violent opportunism has nothing to do with sex.
When did the Cheng pirate exist?
That was in the 1800s.
Well, our thanks to our speaker, Captain Jeff Klein, Senior Lecturer in the Naval Postgraduate School's Operation Research Department at Monterey. We also thank our audience here and on radio. And now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, enjoying its second century of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.